Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and his latest book just out is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Robin. It does seem that lately capitalism appears to be more compatible with authoritarian and kleptocratic regimes like Russia, China, Turkey, the Philippines. And while they seem to be doing well in terms of the rewards of capitalism, it seems that amongst the democracies, the opposite appears to be true.
Yeah, I think it turns out that housebreaking capitalism, taming capitalism via democracy, so that we have the dynamism of a market economy, but we keep the more toxic tendencies of capitalism in check, that turns out to be difficult. And it turns out to require very, very strong democracy, people who were mobilized through institutions like trade unions and movements, and it's more fragile than maybe we thought it was. I mean, there was a period after World War II when it looked like managed capitalism was the norm, and fascism was kept at bay, and capitalism was fairly balanced in its prosperity. But that 30-year period, as I explained in the book, looks more and more like the exception, and it's going to be very challenging to get it back.
Well, of course, FDR was vilified by the capitalists at the time when they crashed the market, but nevertheless he rescued capitalism, and arguably from 1947 to 1977 we had what's the closest to social democracy in this country. And then
he didn't rescue capitalism. He turned capitalism into more of a mixed economy, or with a little bit of a stretch, maybe something closer to social democracy.
Right. But isn't that at the heart of it, the social democracy that we've, I guess starting with Reagan, we roll back what vestiges of social democracy we have compared to, say, the Europeans? I mean, when you talk about trade...
Europeans have rolled it back, too.
Right.
I mean, just the fact that you have a big welfare state, which is necessary to compensate for the extremes produced by capitalism. Having a big welfare state is not the same as having social democracy, much less democratic socialism. And I think you're seeing, with some differences, the same tendencies on both sides of the ocean. That is, you're seeing managed capitalism getting away from us. You're seeing the usual suspects, namely owners of great wealth, regaining their usual power in a capitalist economy. And after a while, ordinary people getting fairly sick of it, but contrary to the dreams of Marxists, that anger goes right more often than it goes left, especially when center-left parties like the Democrats in the U.S. and the German Social Democrats discredit themselves by getting into bed with globalism. And the people say, well, show me something else, and that just becomes bait for neo-fascists.
Well, there is a really telling graph that shows how household income and productivity have run in tandem for decades. And then starting at the beginning of the 1980s, the lines diverge, where all the rewards of productivity go to capital and household income and labor start to flatline and decline. And that's exactly what Marx warned about, wasn't it?
Well, look, Marx warned that capitalism would sow the seeds of its own destruction, but I think Marx was really naive about one thing. He was naive about the appeal of nationalism. And the workers of the world, rather than uniting, the workers of each country looked to ultra-nationalists to lead them to salvation. And it turns out that that's the course of easier resistance than uniting the workers of the world, which turns out to be very, very hard. And so what happens more often than not this is another reason why Roosevelt was such a great exception, is that when people feel that their livelihoods are being taken away from them by the globalizers, they look to nationalists and they look to neo-fascists. And that's what happened in the 30s, Roosevelt being the great exception. And that's tragically what's happened in the past 20 years or so. And I think for centrist liberals, Clinton and Schroeder and Blair, to get into bed with finance and then try and get people to be open-hearted about immigrants, that's a toxic brew. You can maybe get white people to be a little bit more open-hearted as they were in the 1960s when the economy is doing well, but when you take away their livelihoods, and then you say to them, oh, by the way, you have to embrace immigrants and you have to embrace transgender people. Boy, that's really tough. Because what happens is people like Trump and company say, hey, look, the same globalists who don't care about your job, they're the same people who are going to take away your guns. And they're the same people who care more about immigrants than they care about you. And they're the same people who think it's okay to kill babies in the womb. And so you get a whole toxic right-wing brew that's one part economic resentment, one part cultural resentment. And unless you've got a very compelling progressive movement, a very compelling progressive leader, that's very tough to counteract.
Well, the divide-and-conquer strategy, though, appears to be effective as opposed to the strategy that Martin Luther King tried to employ before he was assassinated. And the idea is that, you know, the Poor People's March was supposed to basically say what whites and blacks and browns have in common, as opposed to the divisions that are being exacerbated by Trump.
Well, yeah, and King and Bobby Kennedy, they did get some traction in the 60s with that message. Certainly the better parts of the trade union movement, the left-wing unions were able to get some traction with that, but it's very tough. It's very, very tough. And there's a, you know, there's a very interesting story about the Swedish Social Democrats. So, I mean, in the 1930s, when the right-wing parties were embracing nationalism, the Swedish Social Democrats very cleverly redefined the idea of homeland. And the idea was that Swedes deserve a homeland that includes decent work and decent health benefits and decent housing. And they married a kind of nationalism to a social democratic ideology. Now, that's great, but then what happens when 10% of Sweden is immigrants? And the whole storyline is, well, you deserve this because you're a Swede. So this is very tricky stuff, and getting the politics of this right for mass movements, for leaders, it's not impossible. We know that from the post-war era, but it's very challenging.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and his latest book just out is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? So it seems as if there's a sort of disparity here in the sense, you know, Oxfam did a report recently that something like 85 oligarchical families control over half of the world's wealth. And it does seem that across the board you have this movement that appears to be inexorable, where more and more wealth is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. Then you have this kind of global roiling underclass that's almost going back to medieval times. And then you have this small sliver of wealth management, lawyers and accountants, and that's a pretty bleak future. So give us a sense of why it seems that the worst tendencies seem inexorable and the defense of democracy seems so difficult.
Let me just answer that indirectly by talking about the role of globalization. And the reason I focus about globalization in this book is that the new model of hyper-globalization after about 1990 was used to supercharge deregulation and make it even harder for the nation state to regulate capitalism. So you ask why this is so hard. It takes very, very, very strong democracy to counteract that. And I am not a total pessimistic person because I see stirrings of democratic movements again. The Blue Wave, the effort that we saw at Parkland, the Me Too movement. I mean, I haven't seen so many stirrings on the engaged left as opposed to the far left, but the left that really wants to, you know, make a practical difference in many, many decades. And so that's encouraging. And that's what it takes to revive democracy, and that's what it takes to harness capitalism in the public interest.
Well, it would seem, though, that the forces, whatever you want to call them, the power elite, is more interested in making us passive consumers rather than active citizens.
Sure, of course.
How long since we taught civics and brought about civic engagement? It seems that it's happening spontaneously, perhaps in response to Donald Trump. But could there be an organized program to make Americans recognize their democratic heritage rather than just pay lip service to the founding fathers and pledge allegiance to the flag, etc., but to do a deep dive into the virtues of a system like, you know, in other words, we talked earlier about social democracy. You know, the argument here amongst the right-wingers and the people like Grover Norquist, who wants to drown the government in the bathtub, is about big government. But the argument really should be about better government. And the simple transaction is you pay your taxes and you elect people that are good stewards of your tax money. I could give you an example. When I took my daughter to Australia when she was about two, everybody said, sign her up for what's called child endowment. It's a national program that every Australian citizen has a right to. And what happens is your child gets $200 a month put into the mother's bank account, not the father's, because the father may drink it away at the pub on Friday night. And, you know, this guarantees that every kid in Australia is going to be fed. And if you're affluent enough, then you basically have a college fund when they turn 18. So that's a government program. I mean, if you told that to most Americans, they wouldn't believe it.
I bet it's fairly popular, too.
It certainly is. It's probably being undermined as we speak.
You just have to get control of the government long enough to enact popular programs like Social Security, like Medicare, and then even when the right wing takes power, the right wing doesn't dare take them away. And that takes political movements. It takes political leadership, and hopefully Trump will serve as such a lightning rod that we'll see an upsurge in popular protest and activism, and we'll get a strong working majority that's not just Democrats, but that's progressive Democrats, and maybe we'll get another chance to do this right.
But do you think there is a correlation? Because in Australia, you have to vote. It's the law. You get like a parking ticket if you don't vote, and you get 90-something percent participation. So therefore, the government, whether it's right-wing or left-wing, has to accede to the majority.
Well, but you've had some... I don't know whether the U.S. or the Australians have more than their share of bad leaders, but certainly Australia's had some.
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't think mandatory voting is a cure-all. I do think reducing barriers to voting, and of course the Republicans lately have been trying to increase barriers to voting, but reducing barriers to voting is an important idea. But, you know, we ran an article by the legendary Marshall Gans. This is at least 30 years ago, called Motor Voter versus Motivated Voter. And I think even though you come up with some technical things that reduce barriers to voting, motivating voters to vote is even more important than reducing barriers. They have to have some affirmative reason why they want to vote. And that takes movements. It takes leadership.
Well, I don't know whether... Is there a way to bring back, revive... We talked about earlier about FDR. Is there a way to somehow teach kids in schools or somehow get the entire country to recognize, if you go back to FDR's, I think it was more or less his final address where he talked about a second Bill of Rights, it is the most inspiring and extraordinary vision of what could have been in this country. Is there a way to revive that?
Sure. It was actually I think it was 1941. I think it was his third inaugural or his message to Congress. But it was a great speech, and it was basically an economic Bill of Rights. So, you know, things are unthinkable until leaders put them into the mainstream agenda. Same with Social Security, same with Medicare. And it takes a rendezvous of leadership and movements. And sometimes you get lucky, and sometimes that happens. And I think if Trump doesn't start a world war and burn us all to cinders, I think the circumstances are pretty good for a massive revulsion, a reaction against the Republicans. I mean, take the tax bill. Trump thought this was going to be popular. Well, it turns out it's not popular because people are understanding that it increased the deficit, and the problem is not the deficit per se. The problem is the way the Republicans proposed to close the deficit by getting cuts in Social Security, cuts in Medicare, cuts in other popular social programs. So, you know, in the last week of the special election in Pennsylvania, which the Republicans managed to lose, they actually pulled ads stressing the tax cut because the tax cut turned out to be unpopular. So I do think this is going to be a good year for the Democrats. I think 2020 is going to be a good year for the Democrats. The more important question is what kind of Democrat. If we get another Bill Clinton or another Jimmy Carter, we can forget about it. We need another Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, there's no question that the tax cuts are unpopular here in California, Bob Cutler, because it was so petty on the part of the Republicans to punish this successful blue state by raising our taxes. I mean, it's extraordinary that anybody in this state would vote for Devin Nunes, but we'll see.
Well, in the states that have relatively generous social spending and relatively progressive taxation, you know, there are probably 30 Republican House seats at risk, where the Democrats are going to run against this alleged tax cut, which was actually a tax increase if you're in one of the higher-cost states.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, it seems to me that what we're up against, well, let me put it another way. The most successful people in the American political landscape, I think, are the Koch brothers. They have really spent their money, and they've got $100 billion to play with. So they've been very effective, and it seems like they sort of get it both ways. On the one hand, by funding the Tea Party, they've thrown sands into the gears of government and made it dysfunctional and made it unpopular. But on the other hand, because they control the Republicans and most of the cabinet are their protégés in the Trump administration, everything that's been enacted so far by Trump has been almost at the behest of the Koch brothers. So is that a way to sort of understand what we're up against here, that really the real issue in America is whether democracy will survive plutocracy?
Absolutely. It's the way wealth is traded in power. And unless we have a massive upsurge of people, we're going to have government of, by, and for the Koch brothers. And we are becoming more like the kleptocracies of of Russia and China, and less like the democracy of Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt. But I don't give up. I mean, I think there is enough left of American democracy. There's certainly enough of a popular upsurge that I think we can take back our democracy.
Well, just in closing, the Koch brothers, though, are extremely aggressive, and we've got to pick up our step here a little bit, because one of the things that's gone under the radar is that they're planning on having a constitutional convention, a so-called convention of the states, and it requires two-thirds of the state legislatures to sign up for a constitutional convention. They're only within six of getting the critical number of 34 states. So they're moving at a clip. And if they do convene a constitutional convention or a convention of the states, the Koch brothers could absolutely start out with a blank sheet of paper, and the entire constitution goes out the window, and they start from scratch. So that,
well, they better do it quickly, because the Republicans are going to lose lots of states
right
this November. So I think we're going to probably dodge that bullet.
I think we'll dodge that bullet, but I bring it up as an example of how how aggressive they are, their program of plutocracy, as opposed to our need to be more aggressive in defending democracy.
Indeed, I quite agree.
Well, thank you for joining us, Robert Cutler. I appreciate it.
Pleasure, always. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, a senior fellow at DeMos and a professor at Brandeis University's Heller School. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, and his latest book just out is Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.